Okay, we're in the season of politics, and I always am interested in finding ways to talk about things like politics in a really helpful and an informative way. And today we have Lindsay Cormack on. She has a book that just came out called How to Raise a Citizen. And in light of this being a really charged election season, we have so many parents that are curious about how to handle the election with their children, how to talk about it, how to handle certain conversations that might come up. And we're going to tackle all of that today with Lindsay. So we'll hop right in because there's a lot of questions to get to. It was very fitting that we're having this conversation because I was driving my daughter to school yesterday, and my older daughter is 4. And obviously, that's a much younger age group than your book is focused on. But we were driving, and we were driving in our like local area, and there was a huge tour bus that was parked outside that had a giant photograph laminated on the side of the bus that was from the Trump shooting in his ear, and he had blood on his face. And I drove by it because that's where the light was and that's how we get to school. And my daughter said, "Mommy, why does that man on that bus have blood on him?" And I was like, oh, this is a fitting conversation that we're having this because I don't have the news going in the house. My younger 2 are 4 and 2. So they're not, obviously, it's not age appropriate for them to be fully aware of what's going on aside from that there's an election. But it's definitely, I'm sure, a topic that comes up a lot in an election like this that can be very, not only controversial and dividing of so many different people, but also have imagery like that around kids of all ages. And as parents, you know, how do we even handle that?
I think that's one of the things is it's kind of unavoidable. And, you know, it's not just driving by buses with like kids younger and younger having little computers and pocket like phones that they can look at. It's, yeah, they're steeped in it.
Yeah. And is there a conversation that you have had with parents on how to be speaking to younger children about this?
Yeah. So in the book, I break it up in like 5 to 9, 10 to 14, 15 to 18. And there's sort of like different guidance depending on what age a child you're dealing with. But the idea that even little ones aren't getting messages just isn't true. Because even if you look at like kids' literature or kids' entertainment, there's sometimes like a government figure, usually like a mayor or something like that. And that person is like often at best a dumbling like little doofus who like can't figure it out. Or sometimes they're like out to do harm to the city that they're in. So they do get like sort of like imagery and narrative around government, even really young.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting time also. You know, I grew up being so involved in any time anyone in our family was doing something political or just in any political season. And it was such a different feeling of us being able to participate. We would go door to door and campaign, and we would go to different headquarters. And, you know, it was a real family event. And now it's such a different time where that's just not, we live in a different world and it's a totally different setting. And my kids are obviously still young, so I try to keep that in mind. But it's a very complicated topic that I'm sure has been interesting as you are 10 days into your book tour of meeting different people from different walks of life on what age is age appropriate to start talking about the election and how do you even have that conversation in a neutral way that allows your child to form their own opinions.
Yeah. And I think the thing that I always like try to talk to people about is you only get 4 or 5 presidential elections before your kids are eligible to vote on their own. And so I really do think like making use of this time is important because you don't get that many of them before they get to go make these own their own decisions. And it has been interesting to see like what people are caring about and what they're worried about. And the other thing that I always tell them is like, our kids learn from what we do and what we don't do. So if they don't see us caring about this at all, if they never see us engaging in a conversation or trying to figure something out, they get the message they probably shouldn't do it either. And you had like a very particularly different experience, like being so steeped in this. But most kids, you know, don't have that. And you're right in saying like right now is very different, where a lot of kids aren't going to be going door to door. They're not going to be phone banking or text banking. And so their sort of interaction with politics is just different.
It is different. It's also wild to me. And I've talked to so many of my friends about this lately. As we get closer to the election, people get more and more passionate about talking about it, whether it's at a dinner conversation or on a work Zoom or in a meeting. It's definitely something that people talk more about. And I always go back to how I grew up, which was I had parents with different views on a lot of different things. And our dinner table conversations were sharing both sides. We would, you know, us kids heard both sides. We were allowed to form our own opinions. And going through your book, that's definitely something that you advocate for with parents of, you know, kids of all ages, really allowing them to form their own opinions, their own thoughts, sharing information. But it seems like that's not something, even as adults, we have any sort of awareness about respecting a relationship or a friendship or any interaction with somebody who has completely different opinions than us. It's like we have to X them out completely, or we can't go to dinner because we don't agree on the same things. And I go back to how I grew up, and I was like, I saw adults around each other all the time getting along totally fine, who had definitely nothing in common politically, but we were still able to be kind and friendly towards each other, and that was okay. Can you talk a little bit about how much that part has changed and maybe what we can do to better that for our children?
Yeah, I think, you know, there's a lot of different societal forces that have kind of pushed or hypercharged this feeling of like, well, if someone disagrees with me, they're either an idiot or they're evil. And I think it really hurts that we have a very cut up bifurcated media environment where, you know, you're going to get things that I'm not going to see. My daughter is going to see things that I'm not going to see. We're all in our own sort of like algorithmically done media diet. And so we don't really have these like shared experiences or shared understanding of important news events to kind of anchor us. And so it makes it kind of hard to find these points of interaction where you say like, oh yeah, that makes sense to me. Or, oh, I was thinking about the same sort of thing. So that makes it really difficult. But I also think we're kind of under-practiced. And this is a multi-generational challenge where when we look at how schools have sort of organized around how they teach politics and civics and government, they've deprioritized that in their curricular time. And so we just don't get as much practice on how to do these sorts of things. And now that we're sort of the grownups in the room, parents of my generation, 10 years older, 10 years younger, we're all sort of saying, you know what? Politics doesn't feel or function that good right now. And something has to change for that to be better. And I think that change has to be us, because it's not like anyone else is coming to save us. We're the system. We're the ones who have to do this. And I spent a lot of last year, I was on sabbatical, and I got to talk to a ton of people about politics. I'd wear this shirt around New York that said, "Let's talk politics," and just sort of like invite whatever the conversation was. Some are wild.
It's risky.
Some are, I know, right? Some of them would be, you know, like, oh, I've never heard about that or never thought about that. But a lot of them were, I don't have anyone to talk to about this. A lot of them were just sort of like, I don't know when I sort of get that interaction, because it doesn't happen at work. It doesn't happen at school. Increasingly, it doesn't happen in our homes. And so I think we need to get into the practice. And that starts with parents saying, okay, we're going to have to do this at home. Let's like tiptoe in it together and try. And that should hopefully ripple into other wider communities where you can have those conversations with people who you don't know as well, who you maybe don't already love, but you can understand there's a shared humanity here. And we're all pretty much just trying to like get to the best outcomes we can. But I think it starts at the home.
Do you think that people now, when it comes to having conversations that, you know, maybe are about politics where people don't agree, are people more aggressive to talk about those things than they were when, you know, when we were growing up or in the past? Or is it just now that we're older, we're more aware of the passion that people have? Because it feels like there's no ability to have constructive conversations with people with different beliefs politically in this particular election.
I mean, when we look at data about how like people say they feel, just like their own sort of ideas about out partisans, We know that it has gotten increasingly negative over time, so much so that people will say, like, I don't hope that my child marries someone who's not the same political party as them because they think it's going to be fractious. So that has gotten worse over time. It's also clear that when we look at the effects of social media on how politicians themselves conduct them, like the things that they're going to say, we know that places like Twitter and places like Facebook really sort of incentivize very fractious, very aggressive, very like extreme position taking and denigrating of other sides. So the people who we see interacting in this, they do that more. And part of that is because of sort of the media environment being what it is. It is something where it's hard to say, like, if interpersonally, you know, we're the most aggressive generation. I think in a lot of ways, we're aggressive online and we're very passive in person. At least that's what I experience in the classroom. Like, if I ask students to write something in, they can, you know, tell me all their things. But if I say, let's have this out in class in a discussion, it gets a lot quieter, a lot more muted, and feelings come down. And so it's hard for me to say, you know, yes, this is happening now and it never happened in the past. But I do know we have a lot of things in the backdrop that make things feel like a heightened level of emotion, a heightened level of aggressiveness. And I think that a lot of people probably experience that.
You mentioned that there was a decrease in prioritizing education around politics in schools. Most noticeably for me in elementary schools, I have a stepson as well. And I was pretty surprised to see how the political semester or learning about how the government works in general has changed so dramatically from when I learned about it and just the information that's presented to the kids. Can you talk a little bit about why that has happened? Because it seems like this would be such an important time to be teaching kids about how the government works in a, of course, not in a democratic or political way necessarily, but just how it works, how we do things, and how they can be informed about it.
Yeah, there's a lot of pieces to this, but the very basic piece is every state gets to decide how they're going to do this because, you know, our federalist system means that like California is going to say something different than Idaho, than Colorado, than New York. And so it's really hard to kind of study these things because once the states decide how they're going to do it, they further devolve that down to like school boards or school districts. And then really it depends on who the classroom teacher is as to what sort of content you're going to get. But around the United States, on the modal form of delivery is like in seventh or eighth grade, you'll get a class that's like US government or US history or world history, and that'll be called social studies. And then you won't touch things again until the second semester of your senior year of high school, where you'll usually get a class called government. That's just like, you know, here's some founding father stuff, make sure you learn everything you know about the branches. Maybe you talk about being ready to vote, but it's just too little and it's too late. Like when we think about every other skill that we do in school, we K through 10 it, or we K through 12 it. We say like, okay, you're going to get a little piece here. We're going to build on it. We're going to scaffold, and then it's going to get harder, and then you'll have mastery over it. We don't do that with US government. We give them very high-level picture views. We then sometimes tell them about the history of it. They see it as like a spectator sport, not necessarily something they can participate in. And so it's not surprising that our 18-year-olds are the least likely to be registered to vote and the least likely to turn out to vote. Also, when we look at just the dollars that are spent on different subjects, for every $50 that goes into STEM, only 5 cents goes into civics. And so that's just one of the like bleak prioritization understandings where you can say like, okay, we're putting our money into what we value and this is how it looks. When we were interviewing teachers, I had 6 research assistants and we interviewed teachers in nearly every US state. We heard this joke repeatedly, which is, you know who teaches social studies or civics? His name is Coach. And that's because the teachers who have these roles oftentimes would not be full-time employees unless they had this other role that they play for a school. When we think about how this deprioritization happens, some of it is like world history, where we have the Cold War and everyone says like, okay, we really need to ratchet up on science, technology, engineering, and math. And I don't really have anything against those subjects. I teach at a STEM school now and I really like it. But we also have this time of like, we have to crowd something out of the curriculum. And coincident with that, we have the rise of the SAT and the ACT. And neither one of those assessments has anything about social studies or anything about civics. Not since 1987 when the SAT, or the ACT, excuse me, took out social studies, have we had a focus on this where kids need to know these things to graduate. And then another sort of sad piece is parents themselves make it harder to teach this stuff in schools. When we were interviewing teachers, it was all after the pandemic, and they expressed that there was like a lot of fear around parental blowback, even if they're doing something very basic. Like if they're saying, here's the 3 branches of government. Congress is the first branch. It's Article 1. If a child hears that and comes home and says, my teacher doesn't like the president, that parent can then like inflame a Facebook group or email a principal or administrator or badger the teacher themselves. And so despite the fact that nearly every teacher we talked to was like, yes, we know they need to know more. We want to do this work. They're really constrained, and their incentive like structures make it so that it's hard to get all that stuff done.
It's so interesting how different that is, because I have such vivid memories of being in high school in my dad's second time running and teachers that I was in class with saying, you know, I don't like your dad. And the idea that now you can be in school and teachers are sitting there terrified of upsetting parents, or, you know, sending parents into a crazy Facebook rant is just so interesting, because when I was growing up, I didn't like hearing, oh, I don't like your dad. But I also was very aware, like, okay, some teachers might agree with my dad's politics and some teachers might not agree. And that's okay, because my parents come from different political parties. Why is that a problem? It's totally fine. So I had such a different view of it. Versus now it's like, oh, you know, so-and-so's family is, they're huge Republicans or they're huge Democrats or they're, you know, they think this, not, don't have your kid go hang out with them. And it's just such a wild time now that I'm a parent myself, how different that is. And also how unfortunate it is to be raising kids of all ages in a world that doesn't accept or appreciate the fact that we can all have different opinions and also still all respect each other and be kind to each other and learn from one another. Like, we don't all have to agree on the same thing. It just seems like such a crazy time to be parenting.
Yeah, I don't disagree with you. And I think part of it is really that we've sort of federalized everything, where we think, you know, what happens in DC is the same thing that's going to happen at the state and local level. And anyone who says I'm a Democrat here is going to have all the Democratic views that everyone in Congress holds, or Republican, vice versa. And we know that that's not true. We know that most people want like to lead good lives. They want like basic things like clean water. They want nice schools. They want good parks and places to go for respite. And those aren't really partisan. And a lot of our quality of life decisions happen at those state and local levels, where party politics is just far removed from most of the decision-making, because it doesn't matter if you're zoning, if you're having liquor licenses. Those are questions of like community decision-making, not necessarily who's a D and who's an R. But yeah, it's hard. And it's hard when we lead with this, I think. It's hard when we say like partisanship is like at the forefront of everything, because it's inevitable. It's a part of politics, but it is certainly not everything and is mostly not what happens at state and local politics.
So we talked a little bit about how your book is divided up with advice on age group. Would you say that 5, since that's kind of the youngest age that you start, is that the most age appropriate time to be talking about politics to your children?
So I think it's important that you feel comfortable talking about politics in front of your kids and to your kids if they're like young, precocious ones, as soon as they're here, because we know they're sponges. We know they're just trying to make sense of their world. If they can see, you know, mom's having a conversation with our neighbor about, you know, are we paving the sidewalks this year? What's in the budget? Whatever. That's helpful. Mm-hmm. That's good. That shows them that you care. I think 5 to 9 is, you know, it coincides with when they're going into formal schooling for the most part. And it's when they can kind of like, we shape the way that they dream. We can kind of say like, you know, here's a person who did something that was great for their community. Here's a presidential candidate. Here's a governor, whatever it is. And they can kind of like have a sense of like, ooh, that's aspirational. And one of the reasons I think that's important is when we ask kids today, what do you want to be when you grow up? Despite the fact that for many years, a lot of them would say something like the president, now that's not even the top 20. The number one is a YouTuber or a content creator, because that's what they see, that's what they aspire to, that's what they're exposed to. And I think we should want to grow leaders. I think if we feel like our politics isn't working that well, we need to say, okay, we have to fix a little bit and hope that there's more hope for the future for them to do the same. But they're not going to get there on their own. And so I think that exposure piece that can happen as soon as they're like 5 in kindergarten, learning how to read and put things together, that's a great place to start.
I love that that's something that we're trying to go back to, because when I think about my dinner table conversations with my grandma growing up, it was always talking about the admiration for people who were in politics and also from all different walks of life and different political parties, but also the idea that no matter what your age, if you felt that you didn't agree with something or that there was change to be made to help people to make the world a better place, that it didn't matter what your age was, that you could help make that change. And that was through different forms of being involved in politics or government or local community government. So I love that that's something that you're suggesting for people to talk more about, because the reality is, I think when people say, oh, I want to be a YouTuber, they think that that's, you know, oh, that person makes so much money that I want to be able to do that. And it's such an interesting time. When we go to the title of your book, How to Raise a Citizen, can you define what it means to be a citizen when we're talking about raising them?
Yeah. And I know that citizen can be kind of a charged word. And I have part in the introductory chapter where I talk about, it's not, you know, about who's legally entitled to this or who can legitimately exercise these sorts of rights. It's not about those sort of like exclusive markers. To me, a citizen is someone who's like a member of a community that can contribute to our shared life, and they need to understand the government apparatus in order to engage and support or oppose things within that system. And so it's more about, how do I understand my own political agency? How do I see myself rooted in this community? And how can I figure out what levers of power exist for me to pull? Not necessarily, can I get access to this sort of healthcare? Do I have the ability to vote? We're all sort of citizens where we are in some capacity. And this is about raising kids who have agency within a system that they understand, instead of just being here and not really figuring out how to wield their own power.
Do you also talk a lot about empowering kids at a young age, or really at all ages now, to be a good citizen? I feel like that's a conversation that comes from not only what you're talking about in your book, but especially around this time where we're in election season and parents might want to know, how do you talk to your kids about politics? But also, here are three ways that you can start raising kids to be good citizens in their community, in their school, in their neighborhood. And do you have like three kind of nuggets of wisdom that you can give to parents on how to talk to your kids about being good citizens?
Yeah. So the way that I think about this is, we need to first recognize our role, which means we are modeling behaviors for them. So they need to see us engaging with processes and systems, especially in our community. Like, for instance, if you have kids who are playing on like a communal basketball court, and they don't have like the basketball hoops keep like falling off or something, your kids are probably going to be mad about that. So the first thing is, recognize our role as the parents, the one who can actually like figure out how to get these things done. But the second one is by letting them figure things out by humanizing government, which means to me, hey, I know that you want to have the basketball hoops fixed. Who do you think we could figure out to like help us with that? And then letting them go do that little research, letting them be your family researcher. Maybe they find out it's a parks department. Maybe it's a city council question. Maybe you're in a small town and it's a mayor who gets these sort of things done, or a city manager. So I think that's the second thing, is letting them humanize it and saying, you know what, there are people who make these decisions. There are people who help us out there. And then the third one is reframing our complaints. Because a lot of times we'll just say like, oh, you know, the city can't get anything right, or, oh, our politicians aren't really working for us. Instead, if we think of ourselves as someone who can like pull on these levers or say, you know what, I just need to figure out a little bit more, usually you can get things done. And I have found that to be true in my life in local politics in New York City. I found that to be true in my friend's life. And even my daughter at her school, when she was like, I don't like that we have plastic utensils. It's like, okay, how can we actually fix this? I might know the thing, but I'm not going to do it for her. I say, who do you think you'd have to talk to about that? And she ended up like gathering a petition, had all the little kids sign it, had some teachers sign on, and they got to have a meeting with their administration. Did they get non-plastic utensils? No. But they did learn a lot in the process, and they did learn about their own agency to like how they could change these things in the future. And you know, if they want to try it again in a few years, they'll probably have some skills that they didn't have before. And so I think it's those things: accepting your role and recognizing it, humanizing it by letting them see who does this work, and then making sure that it's not just complaining. It's like, how do we fix things instead of how do we complain about how things are?
I love that that's how you tell people to raise good citizens, regardless of what their parents or their family's political beliefs are, regardless of what state they're from or what their thoughts are on this election. It really does come down to, you know, how you can make a change to make the world a better place, to help other people and to leave the world better than you found it. I was driving down the street the other day, and we have quite a few potholes here in Los Angeles. And my daughter kept saying to me, "Mommy, I don't like it when you go over those potholes." And I said, "I agree with you, but you know, these are some of the streets in Los Angeles have potholes." And she said, "Well, who can we call to fix it?" And I was like, "Well, there are a couple different people that we can call. And even if I don't necessarily agree or love, you know, who we have here, I'm like, okay, well, we can talk to this person. Isn't that cool that this person is the person who gets to make some decisions about making the streets nice and smooth? Now, this is something that we can go." And she said, "I want to talk to that person about these potholes." I said, "That's great." So I love that that's a conversation that you're encouraging parents to have, whether it's uneven sidewalks, potholes. And it's so interesting to me as a parent now to see what kids notice. Like I don't think I paid any attention to potholes when I was 4 years old, but now kids might be paying attention to them, and you can empower them to know that even at 4 years old, they can be maybe making a change in their own way.
Or thinking about it, right? So like a four-year-old's going to have a hard time convening like a little conference call of city council members.
Of course.
But they can do art for change, right? They can draw pictures and send it in to the people. You can ask for meetings with them and let them say, "Oh, you know what? This little person does care about it." But I think what you said about empowering is really the message here. Because a lot of times we're kind of taught that like, this is the government structure that you're in and like, you got to figure it out, but there's not much that you can do as an individual in it. And I don't think that's true. I actually think one of the most beautiful things about being in a democratic republic is that you do get to change the outcomes. We are the people who the power derives from. And I think letting our kids know that and showing it to them early lets them kind of like dream a little bigger, wonder how they can make things better. And a lot of times at these like small local things, you can get things done. It just takes a little effort.
So as we get closer to election day and as things get more charged and more passionate, what's your advice to parents about how to handle and manage what goes on in the media and what to allow and what to not allow in their homes?
I think it's a very hard question because when we say like the media, there's not a singular. It's like, I'm going to see things that are different than my college students are going to see. And so I think there's two things to keep in mind. One is I think the direct look at a congressperson or a person who's running for office is always better than a mediated look. And what I mean by that is like, if we have a debate that's going on for like your governor's race or the presidential race, I think it's fine to let our kids watch that because those are the people who are saying the things that they mean to say or presenting themselves to the United States as they're trying to present themselves. Would I say, let your kid run onto Instagram and like go doom scroll through a bunch of like remixes of the debates? No, that's probably not that helpful. But I do think the direct part of like, let me see how these people are trying to present themselves is helpful. And the second thing that I think is important, especially with kids as they get older, is to just have the ability to say, hey, what are you hearing on this? And that might mean, can you show me what your feed is giving you? Because it's certainly not what my feed is going to give me. And just making sure that you kind of understand their entry points or what their sort of like inputs are to politics, instead of saying this is the right thing to watch and that's the wrong thing to watch. I think it's better to take the approach of like, let's just figure out what we are seeing, because it's really hard to say like only look at this source or this is the one channel we're going to watch. It's unrealistic. And instead, I think it's better to say, what is appealing to our kids? What are the things that are getting into their algorithms? And just sort of like having a pulse on that on occasion to check in and say like, oh, that's not what I'm seeing, but glad I know a little bit more about what you're seeing.
And what is age appropriate when you're talking about having kids watch, if it's a local debate or if it's, you know, the presidential debate, what age is age appropriate for kids to be hearing? Because a lot of the topics that we're also talking about in the presidential debates are, you know, they're very serious, intense topics that probably have a different or a wide age range of when it's appropriate, or kids might not even know what certain topics are about. So what age do you think is safest for people to allow their kids to know what's going on in politics?
If we're talking about a presidential debate, I don't think there is a minimum age. This is not something that's going to have like explicit language for the most part. This is not something that's going to have like topics that they're going to understand in a gory detail, because that's not the setting of a debate. I do think it is okay for our kids to hear the words abortion. I think it's okay for them to hear the words war, because these are real things that exist in their lives. And I'll also tell you, in my own experience talking with my daughter about these things, kids come to these with a less prejudicial and less fearsome understanding of it because they just aren't there yet. Like, they're just sort of trying to make sense of their world and figure it out. And so I don't think they'll probably be scared. If anything, they're going to fine tune their own sort of like internal barometer of like, what do I like? What do I not like in just how a person is, not necessarily piecing together their like political views or saying, here's how their policies are going to affect me. That's just kind of outside the realm of children's minds. But I do think it's important that we get them into the tradition of seeing like, here's how we determine who gets this power. We watch them, we ask them questions, and they go back and forth with each other. I don't think it would be unsafe to even put like a four-year-old if they were staying up late enough to watch it. Now, they might not want to, right? And I wouldn't say like force your kids to watch this with you, but I wouldn't make it off limits either.
When you look at the future for our kids and getting to a place where government, citizen, just all of these different topics are taught to children in a really well thought out, thoughtful manner of raising children to be not only mindful, good, considerate human beings and citizens, but just also really informed children and people, and not having that fear that you were saying teachers have about touching these subjects. Are you hopeful about that?
That's a great question. I think the work is going to be long and hard. I think if we look at like how state legislatures are sort of approaching teaching generally, it tends to be more restrictive versus expansive. That's not to say that there's not bright spots. There are states that are passing different laws that say, you know, we need to have X many hours on this, or we need to have our students show us that they have some sort of civic capability before we grant them a diploma. I do think, though, it's something that we really need to change the narrative around this. Instead of government being something to be avoided or annoying or stressful or frustrating, I think the idea of recognizing that government is actually truly hopeful, it is where we create change, it is how we better our lives, and it is something that we should all have access to influence. I think that narrative sort of like trickles into a bunch of different ways, where it's both people in their homes talking about it, but also when we think about what schools teach, those are political decisions. That's a school board, right? That's someone who says like, here's how we're going to do this. Or that's state politics that says, here's how we're going to change the way that we incentivize teachers, or here's who we're going to hire. And so I think it's long. I think it's hard. I think it's kind of what we have to do, because we sometimes think about politics as like this ship that we're like all passengers on. It's like, oh God, I don't like where it's going. When in reality, we're the crew. Like, if we want this to work better, we have to steer it in a different way. And so I think we kind of have to, because I don't know that this is working for a lot of people right now.
No, I definitely don't think that it is. I think I don't know that anybody that you would ask, and this is probably a really interesting part of a book tour like yours about talking about, you know, these subjects, is like, are you asking people, are you satisfied with the landscape of how we talk about these things overall? I would be so surprised if you find people who are like, this is where it's at. I feel good about this. And this is a great place to raise our children in this climate of political tension.
Yeah, a lot of people, no one really tells me like, I'm so pleased about everything. But there are people who can find like stuff that they are happy with. People who like how their local government works can say it. Like, I was in the town of Olathe, Kansas, and Olathe is a town that has pretty homogenous population, but they have a part-time mayor, and they have like things that are set up where they have free live concerts that are free because they're taxpayer funded, but it's like people can bring out lawn chairs, they have food vendors that are affordable, they have them on like summer weekends, and it's like a nice way for people who are young, middle-aged, and old to just get together. And Olathe's like, this is a value for our community. We want to have spaces where people can come together and enjoy some music. That's a nice thing. It's like, yeah, that's good local government at work. And I went to one of their concerts this weekend. I was talking to people about it, and it's like, yeah, people like that. And they just sort of have to like see it. And they don't think about that as like, oh, that's our Republican part-time mayor or something. It's like, no, this is just someone who's like, oh, the community is better if we have third spaces to hang out. And I think it's sort of like talking about those things and recognizing that so much of what we do is that sort of politics, not are we going to pass this big omnibus bill? Is the government going to shut down? It's a lot of like these smaller quality of life decisions that happen in state and local government places.
I wish we as a country shine more light on local governments that are doing a really good job at that and that are also leaving citizens in that area not distracted by who's, you know, who has an R or a D by their name, but really about the well-being of the community or the town as being the priority of the mayor. So I love that that's part of it. I know we're going to wrap up here, but I do want to ask about the anxiety part of being in a political season. As we've talked about this whole conversation, so many of these subject matters are really charged ones for so many people. There is, you know, as grownups, I think we could do such a better job having conversations with our peers about different topics that maybe we don't necessarily agree on, but we can agree to disagree and still be respectful and kind to one another. When it comes to children or, you know, teens being exposed to different things, maybe if it's walking by a TV where the news is on or a debate is on or hearing something on social media and feeling anxious about something that was said or anxious about the climate of violence and aggression and people being really aggressive about their views and their choices being the right ones and the best ones and nobody can say anything different. For kids who might be exposed to that and parents wondering how to handle political anxiety being passed on to children or being exposed to kids, do you have any advice on how to navigate that?
I think it's a true risk. I think some of the environments where we do our like learning can actually increase anxiety around these things. So if you like, you know, if you're stuck on Twitter or if you're stuck on TikTok and you're in a loop where you just keep hearing these sort of like scary things, that's like not healthy. I think something that we can do as parents is make sure our kids know that they can go to us, because a lot of families and a lot of communities will have sort of like a taboo around talking about politics. You might say like, that's impolite. We don't do that in our family. I think that's something we need to get over and through and know that our kids, or make sure our kids know that they can come talk to us. I also think, and actually the science sort of bears this out, it's much harder to be anxious about something if you understand the limits of power or if you understand what's actually possible. And so I think by making sure that you commit to having a well-rooted understanding of what our government can and can't do, what the true threats are against things like election security, or if you're worried about like sort of like national security, sort of like being aware of like how strong we actually are at these things, I think that helps. But I think the number one thing is making sure that our kids know that they can come to us instead of having to process these things in their own heads, because it's hard. They're not equipped to do it yet. But if they don't have anyone to talk these things out with, it's only going to spiral and get worse. If they can talk to you, if there's parts of your family that they can get into these subjects with in a calm way, that shows them it doesn't have to be all bad. And so I think we just need to be willing to opt into that.
I love that. I think, you know, allowing kids to know that it's safe, that they can come to them, kids can come to parents. I think that's such a huge gift to be able to give kids in a judgment-free way. That's
absolutely
the big thing.
Yep.
I'm so grateful for this conversation. I think it's such an important one. I think your book is so needed and these conversations are so needed. So I'm excited to put up this interview and to help parents, no matter what their political beliefs are or where they live or how charged or not charged they are on certain topics, just having awareness being this close to election day is so important and will get people thinking and hopefully having constructive, respectful conversations with one another and getting back to that place. So thank you so much. And congratulations on the launch of your book and the success around it.
And thank you for taking this on. I know these conversations feel daunting and I know that it's not anyone's favorite topic, but I do think we have to do the work. So I'm appreciative that you're willing to sit down with me.
Thank you so much to Lindsay Cormick. If you want to get a copy of her book, we have all the links. It's called How to Raise a Citizen. I love these conversations. They're so important to have no matter what your political beliefs are. How do we talk to our kids about politics in a really calm, mindful way? How do we lead by example and also empower the younger generation to know that they are capable of making the world a better place and changing things that maybe they don't agree with? So thank you, Lindsay, and we'll hear more about her book tour soon.